into the gasoline pool, which we did. After a number of years of doing that and having MTBE and demonstrating that that this gasoline reduced emissions and so forth, I remember in the early years having a car, a test car, down at Independence Mall, across from Independence Hall, with two carburetors, and going down there and showing as we switched from one to the gasoline containing oxygenates, why emissions went way down and so forth. Well, it turns out that the inclusion of oxygenates in gasoline did have some impact on certain gaskets and other things in automobiles. And to make a long story short, the automotive companies worked with us and changed that. And everybody approved this gasoline for use, except Chrysler, in its warranty, did not allow for the use of this gasoline, although we had tested Chrysler products extensively and knew that there was absolutely no problem. But there was an investigative reporter here in Philadelphia by the name of Herb Denenberg, who somehow put these two things together and accused us of selling the gasoline which damages people's cars. And that was an interesting experience for me, because I tried to go on television live with him, but he never would let us do that. He did an interview with me, I remember, and then just used an excerpt. And he said, I'll always remember when I went to see him, he said, I'm going to give you a few instructions, he said, because you executives, when you go on television, always look stupid. And he said, the first thing is, don't smile. He said, and the second thing he said, just answer the questions and so forth. So I said to him, oh, well, wouldn't you like to do this live? I said, you know, you can, if you think I'm going to look stupid, why, I'm sure you'd like to do this live. I'd be more than happy to do it live with you. He said, no. He said, I'm going to tape you. I said, well, I know what you're going to do if you tape me. You're not going to let me say my side of the story. He said, well, you either want to be taped or you don't. And so we did tape a brief segment, and where I issued a challenge to him, and whatnot, but they never showed any of that. As a result of that, we took a terrific beating in the marketplace. We lost about 30% of our volume, and mainly because, and it's a very interesting lesson, mainly because people thought we had tried to deceive them, not because they thought the gasoline would damage their cars. As a matter of fact, we issued a full-page newspaper ad saying that if there was any damage, we would pay for it, and that I think we had one or two claims where we paid $25 or $30 just to get rid of them. There was absolutely nothing wrong with this gasoline and so forth. But as a result of that, the business dropped off. The company was on the West Coast, the headquarters. They never had fond memories of Philadelphia anyway, and they decided to sell it. They sold it to this oil trader, John Deutsch, and he subsequently sold it to Sun. But as a result of that, nobody knew what to do with the Houston refinery, and some brilliant strategist in Los Angeles said, well, it's the perfect time to test this theory. It can prepare petroleum feedstocks, and let's integrate the two. Well, it turns out that of the 300,000 barrels a day, it's only a few thousand barrels a day that the petroleum feedstocks. And basically, you've got a refinery. It's going to sink or swim on the economics of a refinery. So, but at that point, we split the company into two pieces, and we were about $3 billion in sales when I took over, and losing $120 million a year. And when we split it into two pieces, the residual Arco Chemical was about $1.5 billion and was profitable, but not fantastically profitable. I forget the numbers, but in any event, we set about to exploit and grow Arco Chemical. It was about $1.5 billion, as I said, and when I retired, it was about $3 billion. And what we did was, and something that I still use today, is we looked for opportunities to incrementally expand capacity through the use of technology and debottlenecking the facilities, where the bang for the buck that you get is enormous, because if you could increase by 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% the throughput in the plant, all the fixed costs are the same, and you get the variable margin, which is quite high. And if you go back and look at what we did with Arco Chemical over the next 5 years or so, and many of the plants were more than doubling capacity without any major capital investments through the improvements in technology and through debottlenecking and just plain good engineering. And as a result of that, the profitability of the company had increased rather dramatically. I might say when I took over in 79, analysts said Atlantic Richfield's chemical operations were worth about $800 million. By the time we were finished spinning off Lyondell and then that went public, and Arco Chemical went public, the assets, and by the way, Arco retained 80% of both operations, the assets had market values of close to $8 billion. So we produced a tremendous value for the parent, and we aggressively expanded Arco Chemical on a worldwide basis. We made acquisitions in Europe of polyol businesses. We built a huge complex in Foss to counterbalance our operation in Rotterdam. We bought a styrene business, polystyrene business in Spain, and later sold that when we sold our plant in Spain. And we dramatically expanded in the Far East. When I took over, we had a PO plant in Japan, but we made a tender offer for a company that was in the polyol business in Taiwan, which was quite interesting. Got almost all of the stock. We put a research laboratory in Singapore and a headquarters in Hong Kong for the Asia. We built a polyol plant grassroots in Indonesia, and built a huge PO complex in Korea. And so we really built the Asian business in a very, very significant way in those years that I was president, those 12 years that I was president. I might say that we never had made any money in our venture in Japan. It was an interesting time, because we had another venture with the same partner, Sumitomo Chemical, called Nihon Oxirane, Nihon Atlantic. And Nihon Atlantic was a commercialization of a technology that I had developed for making linear alkyl benzenes. And we always were very profitable, I went to Japan after we bought Oxirane, and I said to Mr. Hijikata, who was an old friend who had become president of Sumitomo Chemical, and the chairman was a man named Mr. Hasegawa, and Hasegawa and Hijikata were members of the board of Nihon Oxirane, and we had frequent meetings there and with them, Dr. Landau, myself, Dick Bressler, whoever. And I went to Mr. Hijikata and I said, Mr. Hijikata, I said, you and I have been friends a long time. We've had a joint venture in Nihon Atlantic for 20 years, and we always have made money in Nihon Atlantic, but we are not making any money in Nihon Oxirane. And he said, I said, what do I have to do to make money in Nihon Oxirane? Because I must make money, and I'm going to expand this business and so forth. And so he said, well, he said, there are a couple of problems with beyond upstream. I said, what are they? He said, you got your 50% interest for technology. He said, you never put any money at risk. And we don't really look at that as fair. We put up all the money, and you own half the company. He said, the second thing is, he said, you embarrassed me and made me lose face with my peers when we did the deal. I said, well, I had nothing to do with that. He said, no, I know that. He said, but he said, let me tell you about it, because it's been a long time, he said, and my anger over it has never really diminished. He said, we negotiated a deal with Halcon and with Oxirane, and I came back and presented it to my board, and he said, and we approved it. And when I went back to discuss it, he said, well, you say we have a better offer from someone else, so the deal is different if you want to do it. And we wanted to do the deal, and we're committed to doing the deal, but you extracted a very high price from us for doing it. And he said, does it surprise you? You haven't made any money. So I said, well, that's all behind us, Mr. Hijikata. Tell me how we make money. He said, you have to put, he said, real money into the venture. And I said, well, how much money do I have to put? He said, well, $15 million. I said, well, Mr. Jakarta, I said, that's difficult for me to do. I can put a couple of million cash on my own signature, I said, but, you know, that's difficult to do without going to the board and so on. We've been losing money here. I said, but will you take it in propylene oxide in product? Can I ship to you $15 million worth of product? And then you can sell it, the company can sell it, and we'll give you the product free, and that's the $15 million. That'll be fine. I said, good. I said, okay, we can do that. I said, but you know, I expect a return on it. You will get a return. You will be very happy. I said, well, okay. Trust me. I said, Mr. Scott, I trust you. There's absolutely no question. I know you will do what you say you'll do. Well, we went from having lost money for many, many years and having a huge amount of debt to being the third most profitable venture in the Japanese chemical industry. And there are a number of lessons from that, one of which is that faith and trust have a lot to do with international joint ventures. And the people have to understand each other and talk to each other, and that's not very easy to do. But once you establish that, people work very well together. And we had a similar experience in Korea and even in Indonesia. So throughout that part of the world, personal relationships are very important and very successful in that, because of the relationships you establish. So that was how we built Asia. And it was a very strong position, and we really were, when I retired, dominant in Asia. In Europe, again, it was the FOSS expansion went well. We built that plant. We expanded Rotterdam several times, and we built an organization. We acquired polyol plants in Belgium and in France, from Rome Clonc and from Adochem, and I forget who the other one was, CDF Chemie, and we bought a PO plant that we later closed down, an old technology chlorohydrin plant, and so that all of those things were done in Europe to build that business. And we bought a styrene business a polystyrene business in Barcelona. That's another story which is very interesting. We bought that from a man called Antonio Emmerich, And in Spain, we have always had a very wonderful contact there, and was chairman of our Spanish company, Montoro, for many years. His name is Joaquin Cano. And Joaquin was in the Franco administration, was a minister, an ambassador to Japan and Germany, and was minister of industry, and the Spanish representative to the World Bank and so forth. In short, a very accomplished man. He was chairman of our company and knew just about everybody in Spain, and introduced us to Mr. Enrich, who owned this polystyrene company in Barcelona. And I'm trying to think of the name of it. I will eventually. But anyway, the Enrich family was running into financial trouble and wanted to sell this business. And they came to us, and we negotiated a purchase price of $8 million for it. And I remember a meeting that occurred where Mr. Enrich needed cash quickly. And he came to me and he said, showed me the first draft of our agreement. The company was called Arahona. And the first draft of our agreement, he said, "Hal," he said, "by the time your lawyers and my lawyers finish this agreement, we'll be bankrupt." And he handed me a letter, and the letter said that we were going to buy the company for $8 million, that I was going to advance him $3 million, and that we were going to do this deal. And I said, "Well, Antonio," I said, "you know, on one hand you tell me that you're bankrupt, and on the other hand you want me to give you $3 million, and so forth." And he said, "This is a simple agreement," he said, "you have my word." I said, "Well, I can't give you $3 million, but I can give you two." And I had a $2 million limit of what I could approve without board approval. And I can give you two. And I said, "So let's just change the three to two, and you sign it, and I sign it, and we'll get you the $2 million right away." So we did. We became friends. We bought the company. Years later, we sold it to Addo Chem for $38 million. We paid $8 million for it. And when I went to Barcelona for the 96 Olympics? No. Maybe, I forget when, but the last Olympics in Barcelona, Antonio Enrich and his family were our hosts. I had my daughter and my niece with me, and it's an interesting story because when we showed up at the airport, he had one of his people meet us from one of his other companies and took us to our hotel, and they took us out that night. I'll always remember, we were tired, but we went first for lunch, and then in the evening we went to a disco. And I think it was called Upstairs, Downstairs. I had dinner. Upstairs, the parents ate, and downstairs were the kids. You couldn't be more than 20, but the kids had a disco downstairs for them, but everybody was there, so you knew where your children were. And it was quite interesting, and it was quite lively. We finished about 4 in the morning. And to make a long story short, we had a date with Enrich to go out on his yacht. And so we hired a car, and they drove us up north of Barcelona on the Mediterranean coast. And I remember as we were pulling into this place, my daughter said to me, "This is not somebody's house. This is a street." I said, no. Those are the servants' cottages, and his house is up there. So we went up there, and we had a drink, and then we walked down steps to the bay and took a motor launch out to his yacht. And we sailed around until he found a harbor he liked, and his daughter and his son dove off the side and went to get these little mollusks, I guess you call them. I don't know what you call them. They were spiny and black, and when you opened them up, they had an orange colored meat in them. That was part of it. They served this wonderful lunch with wine and whatnot. And then he told my daughter the story, which I've told you, and said, "Your father is a friend of mine for life," he said, "because he saved my family and my company," and so forth. And so we had a delightful time on the yacht, and I think it was about 110 feet, so it was a reasonable size boat. And we went back and had heard mass in the chapel in the village that they were. It was a Sunday, Saturday evening, and then went back and enjoyed the games in Barcelona. Again, you know, it's the relationships that the one thing. The chemical industry is an industry where relationships are very important, and not only in throughout the world, but in the United States. It's a small industry, and you know, the top 50 or 60 people of the business know each other through the Chemical Manufacturers Association and so forth. So let me get back to Mr. Cano, Joaquin Cano, who I still see as a friend today. I still see Enrich as a friend, and I regret that I haven't been able to get to Japan to see Mr. Ichikawa, who subsequently became chairman, although I have seen the new president of Sumitomo a couple of times in Europe. But to make a long story short, one day with Kano, it was just before Christmas, I get a phone call that socialists had taken over the government in Spain, and a phone call, our contact with the 50% share of the government was owned by Enpetrol, Spanish Petroleum Company. Our contact there was a man named Felix Espila Cueta, and Felix called and said, the government has decided all former Franco ministers must be purged from any government-owned companies. And I said, Felix, I said, you know, it's the day before or 2 days before Christmas. And he said, it has to be done by the first of the year. And I said, well, the answer is no. And I said, you will recall that the joint venture agreement says to replace the chairman, we need unanimous consent. The answer is no. He says, it's impossible. I said, Felix, I'm leaving to celebrate Christmas. We'll talk about it after the first of the year. Well, you can't do that. I said, well, I've just done it. I hung up. When I got back to the office, January 3rd or 4th, whatever it was, there was a delegation from Spain waiting for me, and it was very interesting. I remember going home and saying to Anne that night, I'm very lucky that this meeting didn't occur in Spain. And I said, because I think I would have had a lot of problems. It was a very angry meeting. These people were very angry that I had defied the wishes of the Spanish government. But anyway, they insisted that we remove Joaquin immediately. And I said, well, I said, I have a problem with this. The man has given us very loyal service for many years, has produced good results, and it has to be done with dignity and honor. And so an immediate dismissal is just not something I can agree with. Now, a resignation at some time in the future, and we cooperate by appointing him as a consultant, would allow this man and his position and his stature to be maintained. I can agree with that. And I would be happy to employ him as a consultant, but you're going to pay half. And so we agreed that in May, at the end of the, before the annual meeting, that he would tender his resignation and be retained as a consultant. And he worked at Argo Chemical for a consultant from that time until when I retired in 1991, and provided us with a lot of useful service in many, many other consulting activities and things as we built, they even utilized them as we built Freedom Chemical. So that was an interesting story. The end result of that story was that ultimately the government there made it so difficult for foreign competitors or foreign joint ventures. They had this dream of creating a Spanish national oil chemical company. And one by one, they forced the joint ventures out. Hearst, ICI, Philips, and we were the last joint venture remaining. And eventually they forced us out. Now, I'll always remember the man there was a man by the name of Jose Diaz Fernandez, and I'm trying to think of the young man who was Spanish who had worked for Philips and had come back to Spain. He died of cancer as a very young man. I'll think of it in a minute. But anyway, they made us an offer of $1 for the business. And we refused and refused. And finally, everybody else was gone. ICI, Hearst, and also their joint venture interest. I refused to sell. But finally, it was very difficult. They were driving the venture into losses because they controlled the raw material supply. And eventually we sold out for $8 million. And I just recently testified for Arco Chemical against them, against Repsol, which was a replacement company for Edmatrol, that they claimed that when we sold, they had the rights to the technology, and we Arco Chemical disagreed with that, and I disagreed with that. They got nothing in terms of technology because they were forcing us out. And it was our policy not to give them, not to license technology. The case went before a tribunal, which I testified at, very much the same as I just discussed, and even indicated that the year after we were forced out, the company made $100 million because the price of styrene had spiked. And I remember saying to the head of the tribunal, it was a difficult time for me because I had to justify to our board why a joint venture that we had made $100 million and I had sold it for $8 million. So you could see that it was not a very good business decision, and I certainly wouldn't have given them the technology to go with it, which is very valuable. Well, the case was ultimately settled out of court by my successor, and they did give them the rights to build a second plant. And I don't know all the details of that or why that was done, but that was the culmination here just last year of those discussions we had back then about the sale of our interest in a company which was called Montoro. So that kind of discusses Europe. I might say that one of the things we did was move our headquarters in Europe to England, we're in Maidenhead, but we used to be in Eton, right by Windsor Castle, and then we had research laboratories in France, and plants in Belgium, Holland, and France, southern France.
What difference operationally was made by going public? Did it affect reality?
Going public gave us, of course, a point and set a value. When we went public, we issued 100 million shares, which were valued at $32 a share, but we only issued 20 million in the marketplace. Arco retained 80%. That was, you know, just before the big drop in the market in 87. And I remember we came out at 32, and a few days later it was at 16 because of the market collapse. I remember Peter Lynch of Fidelity calling me and asking me what was happening and what was going on, and I said to him, "Well, Peter," I said, "personally, I'm buying everything I can buy, and so is the company." And I said, "At $16 a share, why this is an enormous buy." And I bought in 3 million shares of stock. It was a big mistake. And even though it was a very low price, and subsequently, you know, a lot of money was made on it, it decreased the float, And so as a result of that, it was hard for big institutions to move in and out of our stock where they like to take a million shares at a time, and so forth. So I think that the fallacy of the Arco Chemical thing was we never really got enough stock out into the marketplace to make it a true public company. It turned out to be a dividend play because we had we paid a $2.50 dividend originally on $32 a share, so $2, I guess, when we first came out. Then it became $2.50, and so the price was really set by the dividend and the yield. You could always
more like a bond.
Yeah, it was. You got your 5.5%. And that was the price. I mean, as the dividend went up to 280, 5.5% of that was the price. And that's the way the stock was marketed. Of course, ARCA was very interested in that, and they wanted the dividend maximized. And of course, I was very interested in growing the company, and there was a built-in conflict there. With Lion Valley, they also kept 80%, but they were not. They never thought Lyondell had great potential, and after a number of years, they sold down their share and eventually got out of it. And of course, they recently did the same thing with Arco Chemical.
What are your reflections, Hal, on the pluses and minuses of that president of a large chemical company CEO role? What was
Well, you know, I think that, first of all, with an 83% shareholder, let's talk about the practical aspects of it. I never had the full control that I would like to have had. From the standpoint that the management at the parent, one, didn't know chemicals, two, didn't understand the business and the industry, and therefore those were limitations on our ability to diversify and make strategic decisions. But apart from that, the freedom to run the company and to do things that were appropriate from a personnel standpoint, I think we're there. And I think we did a lot of unusual things. We had very good employee benefits and policies. We had virtually no, in my opinion, discrimination against women or minorities, and we encouraged the growth of women and minorities in the management team. I tried, and I think was reasonably successful in developing an environment that people liked to work in, cared to work in, paid them well, gave them good benefits, but demanded a great deal from them in terms of their work ethic, in terms of their ability. I think we tried to get an entrepreneurship and innovative ability down through the banks, and I think we were quite successful. If you look at the number of people who left Arco Chemical in the years I was there, gone out and formed their own businesses and own companies, I think that speaks to the ability to develop a truly entrepreneurial spirit. So I think I was able to hone the beliefs that I have in management and the importance of various aspects of how you manage a company while I was there in the 12 years. And, you know, I've always believed, as you well know, that if you communicate with people and let them know what it is you want to achieve, tell them how you expect them to achieve it, and then share with them the benefits of achieving it in some way, people will rise to extraordinary heights. And I believe that very strongly. And I also believe that one of the key aspects of management is getting extraordinary performance out of ordinary people. And I think we tried very well to do that. And and were successful. I think if you look at the record over the years that I was there, we were among the top performers in terms of profitability and returns of any company in the business. So I'm very proud of what we accomplished there, and I think we built a strong team and a cohesive team, and we were among the first to recognize that the business was a global business. We had a well-balanced global environment. We were strong believers, as I told you before, that technology was the key to success. And we used to say that we looked for things that had a technological advantage, a strong market position, and a real cost advantage rather than a perceived advantage. Everybody thinks that they have an advantage, but I'm talking about a real advantage. So those were the keys to success. We were very risk-oriented, willing to take risk, as much risk as the board would let us take. And I'd say, you know, if you say, ask me what do I think one of my attributes is that I'm able to tolerate a substantial amount of risk and take a substantial amount of risk, and I think I've done that after I left ARCO. But I don't do that without being adequately prepared and having made a judgment that the risk is worthwhile. Sometimes you fail. And one of the early things I learned from Bob Anderson was that you can't have a risk-free environment and that you are going to fail occasionally. We had two things back-to-back that were failures that were very interesting. They occurred early in my career as president. You remember I talked about the Meg plant and having to shut that down and write it off. But simultaneously with that, we had a research program, to develop a new isocyanate process to make MDI, which are polymeric isocyanates. There are two, the other is toluene diisocyanate, one for flexible, one for rigid foams. And I guess one of the mistakes we made was we announced that quite early that we were going into that business. And that put everybody else in motion to improve the existing technology. And they did ultimately improve it. So the point was that when we were commercializing this new technology, we didn't have an economic advantage. And also we had some problem with complete removal of selenium from the product. Selenium was a catalyst in the product. And we thought that would have an impact, although we all know today that for good dietary reasons, we take selenium. So I never quite understood that, but nonetheless, there was data that said selenium was around and so forth. But to make a long story short, we canceled that project, took a write-off. It was a large one, about $75 million. And it was an interesting thing. I, at that time, was being honored by the National Italian American Foundation. And I remember very well, my mother and my family came down from New York, and I just finished receiving this lovely bowl. And one of my executives came over to me after the presentation was over and I had made my remarks and said to me, "I really got to talk to you," he said. I said, "What's the problem? I'm enjoying myself, my mother's here," and so forth. He said, "You're going out to Los Angeles someday and you're going to be fired." And I said, "Well, you know, Jack," it was Jack O'Pester, I said, "Jack, that's impossible. Because if I'm going to be fired on Monday, I'm going to have to give this bowl back." And I said, "Surely the company wouldn't want me to have to give this bowl back. I just got this bowl." So he said, "I'm serious, and you're not taking me seriously." I said, "Well, what can I do about it, Jack, now?" I said, enjoy the evening. So I flew out to Los Angeles on Sunday. And I remember walking into Bill Kieschnick's office, and I said to him, hey, Bill, I said, I thought we might as well get an early start. He said, what's up? I said, well, everybody in Philadelphia says you're going to fire me. He said, where'd you hear that? I said, well, there's a lot of rumors, I said. And unfortunately, I said, they're even outside the company. I had a call from my friend Johnny Johnstone at Olin. I said, and he said he had heard the rumor. And Bill said, it's just not true. I said, well, I said, I think we can both learn a lesson here. I said, you know, we're having our problems. We're having a lot of problems. And an occasional encouraging word from you or Bob to the staff here would have a great impact, because the staff here all thinks you're going to fire me. And I'm saying that's how those rumors get started. And I said, you know, it would be helpful if occasionally you guys just reinforced your commitment to the management and the company and so forth. Anyway, we had the meeting. Bob Anderson was his typical self. He said to me, well, he said, you're going to shut it down and write it off. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, is that the end of it? And I said, I think so. He said, well, he said, let's just get it behind us and move on. Behind us and move on. And that was the end of the discussion. There were never any recriminations or anything else. He was able to tolerate risk, and he knew that you weren't always successful, and never mentioned again. It never came up. Never any finger pointing and all of that. So I learned a lot from that. We went on to grow a great company, and it was an interesting when he left. He retired, things changed, and the company became even more conservative. And I think that's part of the problem that they're having today. The people who replaced Anderson, instead of being entrepreneurs, were really caretakers, and you can only do that for so long, and before the company begins to wind on down. So that's kind of where we got to. I wanted to go back and mention one thing, was that when we brought Oxrain into the fold, bought Ralph Landau's piece of it, a couple of years later we wanted to integrate it and stop operating as a separate company. We combined the research and so forth, moved the people from Princeton here, and at that point Cy Baldwin was running Oxrain. And I said to Cy, I said, look, Cy, I think we'll never get this thing together unless we just integrate with our other operations. And you know, here's the organization chart. Pick a job. You can have whatever you want. He said, I want to run my own company. And I said, well, Cy, that's just not feasible. It's just not feasible. And you can have any job you want, but I've got to integrate this thing. He said, well, then I think I'll leave. And I said, well, you've got a very fine contract. So, you know, feel free to leave. Which he did. And he teamed up with Mark Brandolia, who had been chairman of Oxrain before we bought it out. And the two of them together built a great company called Cambrex. Cambrex, I might say, is on the front end of fine chemicals and biotechnology, supplying materials to people engaged in stem cell research today, which is one of the newer areas. And they built a great company, and they've done very, very well. And Cy and Art both are still very good friends of mine. So that was the end of Oxrain as we knew it, and its integration into the chemical company. On MTBE, which is something I talked about before, we had this thing by Herb Denenberg, and the exposure that we had these so-called oxygenating materials, which were bad for your car, and whatnot. Of course, that was proven not to be true, and eventually the government mandated the use of MTBE. But the interesting part of that story is it was a product. I've been associated with that product since the 60s. Here it is in the 90s, coming upon 2000, almost 40 years.